How do we rein in the rising number of hate crimes? FBI statistics show Michigan has seen hate crimes go up for the second year in a row. Indeed, of the 50 states, Michigan is number 4 in its number of hate crimes. State Attorney General Dana Nessel has begun a new hate crimes unit where reportedly hundreds of complaints have already been lodged. Civil rights groups say after the election of President Trump, there's been a spike in hate crimes and people joining white nationalist groups, which leads us to Derek Black. He was born into a hothouse of white nationalism, actually seen as the future of the white nationalist movement. But an invitation to a Shabbat dinner from a college classmate started Derek along a path that led to him rejecting everything his family had taught him. He'll be telling his story this coming Sunday at the Holocaust Memorial Center in Farmington Hills. He is here with us now. Derek Black, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So it is absolutely no exaggeration to say that white nationalism was what you were learning from your first breath. Your father, Don Black, created Stormfront, the first major hate site on the internet. Your godfather, David Duke, the former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. So growing up, Derek, what did you believe about white people, about people of color, people who were Jewish? What were your beliefs?
For the decades before I was born, my family had been central to trying to mainstream what they termed white nationalism, which is really indistinguishable from white domination and white supremacy. And they had spent all of their lives as their primary goal was to try to take it from being a fringe movement into something that much larger groups of people could identify with. And the tenets of their belief were that race was super real, was not a construct, but was actually something biological that predicted all this stupid stuff about people, that you could tell crimes people would commit, specifically that non-white people were going to commit more crimes, and all these things that do not hold up in any way, but have a really long legacy in America. And the white nationalist movement still does base it all in a very firm conspiracy theory about anti-Semitism, that it is Jewish people in this organized global conspiracy that are promoting multiculturalism and immigration and integration, and who are responsible for all the improvements in society for the lives of people of color. It's sort of a condescending conspiracy theory that it's that advancements in society are not made by the different groups in America that have faced oppression, but that it's a Jewish conspiracy that promotes it at the expense of white people. And from the time I was a kid, that was what we always learned.
So when a white nationalist commits some very violent act, let's point to Dylann Roof, who knew Stormfront. He was on that site a lot, killing 9 black worshipers at a church in Charleston. How would your father have put that in context? What would he have thought of that?
Every time an attack like that happens, his explanation is always that it is a series of very unfortunate coincidences that people who came on and read the website and were engaged in the white nationalist ideology then went off to commit violent crimes. Like he would say, you don't blame Google when somebody searches on their website and then goes out and commits crimes. And it's a complete fallacy, like baked into the white nationalist ideology, even though the vast majority of people involved in this movement are not committing violent crimes. Like that is true. The however many thousands of people are involved in it, baked into the ideology itself is the call to violence. Like my father would never call for violence. Crimes and advocacy of crimes are illegal on Stormfront. Like you're banned if you say things that are illegal on Stormfront. But the basic ideology is that whole swaths of people living in America don't belong here and are taking from us and are not us and are hurting us. Like this oppositional us versus them language, it's an implicit call to violence. And the fact that they do not take responsibility for their role in it is unconscionable.
When you headed off to New College of Florida for your undergraduate study in history, people in the white nationalist movement definitely knew you. You were really a star in that movement. But you kept all of that very quiet until April 2011, and you're overseas doing a study abroad semester. Somebody researching terrorist groups comes across you, and that news lit up the campus. You were outed, but you came back, kept attending classes. How did students treat you?
Because I was not on campus, I initially got to view that from afar, reading the student forum, which was an email forum where everybody on campus could speak their mind and read what was going on. And that was my first experience of the campus reaction. And it was, from the beginning, sort of a debate about whether we should reach out to this guy, me, whether we should reach out to this person just advocating white supremacy on the radio and in on a website and online and to the media, or whether we should ostracize him in order to assert that we value people of color and Jewish people and people who are threatened by this ideology. And there were definitely people who took this position like, oh, we should reach out, which I think becomes important in my story. Like, it's essential that people did that. But I also really want to make the point that the ostracism was essential too. It didn't feel good. It felt really bad. But the fact that this small campus community that I had gotten to know for a semester before they knew anything about my background was articulating that I was making their lives worse by what I was advocating, and that I was factually wrong, and that I was misrepresenting statistics, and on, these people who I'd gotten to know were telling me, either to my face or on the student forum, that what I was doing was awful. Like, that was the precondition to even considering talking to some of the people at the Shabbat dinners or any of the people who reached out to me and asking them, like, do you agree with this? Like, is what I'm doing actually so wrong, or do they misunderstand it? It's the ostracism that was the first thing. It was essential. I think it always is essential.
That is something. And then you mentioned the Shabbat dinners, and your conversion, if you will, began with an Orthodox Jewish student named Matthew Stevenson saying, what are you doing Friday night? And he invited you to his weekly Shabbat dinner, and you accepted. Why?
I mean, there's sort of a basic level that there were not too many social events that I was being invited to. But I also knew Matthew. Like, I had been on campus for a semester. He had lived catty corner to me in the dorms. We had taken some of the same classes and shared study guides. I would play my guitar out on the stoop by my dorm, and he would come out and sing along. We had each other's cell phone numbers. And when I came back, he wasn't just some random student. We weren't extremely close, but he was somebody who I knew. And I knew that it would be at least an interesting social event. And I knew him, and I said yes. And I probably thought that I was only going to go once, but it was this sort of social connection that I think, looking back on it, it illustrates that you never know what impact you can have. Like, you never know what connection you have and what input you have to another person. And it's different for everybody. But the fact that Matthew took the fact that we had each other's numbers and we sort of knew each other to say, I'm going to invite him and see what happens, it's just, it's amazing to me.
And the story of these dinners and your circle of friends changing and growing, including a roommate of Matthew's named Allison, who wouldn't even come out of her room the first night you turned up. But friendship grew, and then with Allison even more, and love grew, and that gave her a space to really begin debating you about your beliefs. And as people confront white nationalism in this country, people who believe what you used to believe, and now you look at it and say it's wrong, it's stupid, what's the key to being able to confront that, talk about it, debate it?
I think it's difficult, because I don't want to be at all giving the impression that what you should do, we have to invite Nazis to dinner and then everything will be fine.
Right.
I think on its face, people understand that there's so much more to it. And it takes a lot of different forms. I want to emphasize that the fact that my campus community was really strongly saying how wrong I was the essential precondition. And that's something that most people can do. And I think it has a lot more value than we sometimes give it. That if you're living in a community where anti-immigrant sentiments are coming up, where things that are attacking groups of people in your community are happening, just asserting that that is not the value that you want your community to be known for or to support, like, that has so much value. That standing in line at the grocery store and a quick comment to somebody, whether it's friendly or even a little bit chastising, can have this impact that you don't know. And so the lesson that I take from it, which is backed up by research, is that everybody has a different role. Like, everybody has a different input, and it's not everybody's place to go protest. It's not everybody's place to run for office. It's not everybody's place to be in media or speaking or so on and so forth. But it is everybody's place to do something, to not be complacent. And whether that's like talking to your cousin at Thanksgiving or whether it is organizing a group in your community, like, it takes so many different forms. But the one thing that everybody at New College did was something. They spoke up, they spoke to a friend, they spoke on the forum, they spoke to me sometimes, like, they spoke to people who felt threatened on campus. Like, they all did something, and that's what's important.
And as in fact, I want to encourage people to check out your story told in a very powerful book by Eli Saslow called Rising Out of Hatred, The Awakening of a Former White Nationalist. It is a very, very powerful read, particularly the point by the fall of 2013 when you accepted that what you'd known all your life was wrong and you wrote basically a manifesto disavowing white nationalism. How did it feel as you sent that statement out to the world?
It's still one of the most difficult things, maybe the most difficult thing I've ever done, because by that point, I had been on campus for years talking to Allison, talking to Matthew, who was hosting the Shabbat dinners, and Allison, who was his roommate. And I thoroughly believed by that point that the evidence that white nationalists used was faulty science and was bad reasoning and that it was actively hurting people in America. But it was still such a difficult move that I did not want to do up until the very end to disavow it, because it wasn't just disavowing the ideas, it was disavowing my family and the cause that they had fought for all their lives and continue to advocate. That break was just terrifying. And it was in some ways kind of worse than I even expected, because it was really unclear whether we would ever be able to speak again after that.
And where are things with your family now?
Extremely tense. They continue to advocate white nationalism and organize one of the largest communities in the world for it. And so we're on these different divides of what is the right thing to do, where we each think the other one is doing the wrong thing. But I give them a lot of credit, because it was somewhat in their court that my parents thought it was important that we be able to stay in touch. I've visited a few times over the last 5 or 6 years since I renounced the movement. And we have some amount of connection that maintaining that to some degree was more important than just cutting it out because of these ideological differences.
Recent FBI statistics tell us Michigan has seen an increase in hate crimes 2 years straight. In fact, of all 50 states, Michigan is number 4 in the number of hate crimes. And now Attorney General Dana Nessel in our state has got a newly formed hate crimes unit. And she's saying she's receiving hundreds of phone calls and emails to this, that people, in her words, are afraid to send their kids to schools to pray in their mosques, which is not the way we should be living in America. From your perspective, where you've lived both sides of the equation, what do we do with this?
There is no easy, easy answer. And it's something that I feel personally not necessarily responsible, but some of the things that people who go and do these violent attacks say motivated them are the same sort of ideology that my family continues to advocate and that I advocated, even if they will say, oh, we're not advocating violence or crime. We're just saying that white people deserve a chance, or whatever they frame it. And so when these things happen, the fact that you can't take them back is unnerving and disturbing. And I try to find answers to it, to how to prevent it. And there's short term, there's law enforcement, but long term, the only real answer I have is that this is a society-wide issue, that white nationalism doesn't come out of nowhere, that it's not an alien philosophy that has nothing to do with America or its culture. The things that white nationalists believe are almost all rooted in racist ideas or anti-Semitic ideas that exist and have existed in America for decades or even centuries. And it is challenging those ideas where they exist in much more moderate ways in large numbers of people that I think is the best way we will take the wind out of the sails of the white nationalist movement. That we have to accept that it's not just these crazy fringe people who perpetuate racism or racist ideas. It's all of us participating in a society that we have to be aware of. We have to be aware of inequalities. We have to be aware of systemic issues. We have to be aware of policing and criminal justice and like things that all feel much bigger than us, but amount to a system that is fundamentally unfair because of racist ideas. And if we can't, as a society, say that we want change, that we don't accept those things, then the white nationalist movement is probably not wrong in saying that they have support for their more extreme beliefs.
Derek, when I think of Charlottesville and what happened in August 2017 when Heather Heyer was killed during that huge white nationalist rally, what did that moment represent to the alt-right?
The moment when it happened, I remember watching the news and thinking at first that It's sort of interesting how brazen they are, that they're not worried about being identified online, which frequently leads to losing your job, and that there were so many different organizations that historically didn't like each other that were together at that event. But I also thought this is going to be kind of a disaster for them because it looked terrible. They had swastika flags. They were trying to appeal to people in Virginia and in the South who want to maintain Confederate memorials, but they showed up and yelled about Jews and swastika flags, and it seemed like and then there was a murder of a protester, and all these things made this movement not seem like the moderate position that they were trying to promote. And I think the thing that really changed that event was the president not being able to condemn them, because people are always able to condemn a white nationalist rally. And the fact that he couldn't do that was something that makes Charlottesville stand out. And overall, I think it has been devastating for them as an organized movement, because America has reacted to the white nationalist movement, and some of the people who showed their faces did lose their jobs. Mm. Like, there has been a social backlash to white nationalism and white nationalists. But regardless, the fact that the president was able to look at that rally and defend them to some extent, it was huge for their movement, and it's going to continue to be huge for their movement.
Facebook responded to the Christchurch, New Zealand mosque shootings by banning white nationalism and white separatism. Is that too little, too late? I'm wondering what more you think social media platforms can and should be doing.
The backstory to that is, I think, somewhat remarkable, but it leaked more than a year ago that Facebook made this moderating distinction between white supremacy and white nationalism, that they would not allow anybody who said they were advocating for white supremacy, but they would allow somebody who was advocating for white nationalism, because nationalism is not necessarily opposition to anyone else, which every sociologist and anthropologist and political scientist in the world who they asked said there's no distinction, that white nationalism is a phrase that was adopted by my family just for this reason, to make it a little bit more palatable, that inherently these movements in America are oppressive and potentially violent towards people of color, towards minority groups. And the fact that it took them more than a year, and the conspicuous timing of it happening after the attack in Christchurch, where a person who advocated white nationalism killed 50 people in a mosque. And I think that we're sort of, as a society, coming to the realization that these private companies are not blameless, that if they promote and help an organization organize and spread its message, that they can't fall back and say, well, we are just supporters of free speech and we allow anything, because they don't allow anything. They decide what goes on their site. And if they decide that something is acceptable and they therefore help that ideology spread and more people come around to it, then they are supporting it, they're promoters of it, and they're platforms for it. I think 2019 might end up being the year where these major companies acknowledge that, even if it's detrimental to their business model.
Derek Black will be telling his story in conversation with me, I'm very happy to say, this coming Sunday at the Holocaust Memorial Center in Farmington Hills. For members of the Holocaust Memorial Center, you can get details by going to that website, holocaustcenter.org. Very glad to have had the chance to talk with you on Stateside, and I'm certainly looking forward to an extended conversation with you Sunday at the Holocaust Memorial Center. Derek Black, thank you so very much.
Thanks so much for having me.